they were asking it on behalf of others. And that's a wonderful thing to do, to ask your question. You know the answer, but you want to do it for the sake of other people. But first of all, once the Della is in here, we have called in the kitchen crew, and if we keep them here too long, it may... Are you having a lunch here today?
No.
No. Oh, so it doesn't matter, you can stay here as long as you like. So I've just heard that of the cooks, we have the head cook, Paula, who cooks heads. And Australia is famous for its cook. You know the first celebrity cook in Australia? Was Captain Cook. He's first celebrity. He's supposed to be the first celebrity. You're shaking your head. You should know better by now. You've been listening to these bad jokes for 9 days. Captain Cook, the first celebrity cook in Australia. So Paula, the cook, how was her cooking? One star? No. Two stars?
No.
Three stars?
No.
Four stars?
No.
Five stars?
No.
Six stars?
No.
Yes. You have Jhana Grove rating 6 stars. So if you want to go to another retreat centre, you can quote 6-star rating. And the helpers, Jack, was he a good helper, Paula?
Yes,
he's your husband, is he?
Yes.
Okay, you've got to say yes. So and the consultant chef, that was Michelle, because she knows where everything is. So, was she a good consultant?
Yes.
Very good. Sometimes it's good to have new people learn the ropes here, but there's an old saying which I heard, that new brooms sweep clean, but the old brooms know where the dirt is. So it's nice being able to know where everything is and how things work. And lastly, Lily, what did you do? Wash up. The dishes were very clean. So, you can't have a nice meal with dirty dishes and also helping out other things. So, was a Lily a 2-star, 3-star, 4-star, 5-star, or 6-star helper?
6-star.
Okay, very good. And it's very hard working at Jhana Grove. People actually put on years when they work here, and apparently Paula just put on one more year today. Because it's her birthday. So we'll give her a blessing for the cooks and especially the birthday. And also all the people who did the finances here. So we have one more cook I want to thank today, and that's Della for cooking the books. And all the other people who helped do the accounts, and also for, where's William? Is he gone already?
Yeah.
Okay, for William who cooked the books for the Indonesians. For those two cooks. Okay, now give a blessing especially for the birthday. And as I say in Bodhinyana, this is a blessing for Paula, and also for everybody else who has a birthday this year. That way, everyone's included. Sabha Roga Vinimuto Sabha Santa Povajito Sabha Vera Mati Gando Niputo Chato Wangbawa Sabitiyo Viva Chantu Sabha Roga Vinasatu mate bhavan vantarayo sukhiti kayu gopava apivadana silitsa nichang vutta pacharino chataro tamavatansi ayuvano sukhang balang. That's the party first. Now, because we are in Australia, we have to now do the Western chanting. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Paula. Happy birthday to you. Hip hip. Hooray. Hip hip. Hooray. Hooray. Very good. Excellent. So, that's all a nice little piece of gratitude, because gratitude is a wonderful quality. And it's not just the cooks, it's not just the organizers, everybody helping out here, each in their own ways to make this a successful retreat. Even the teddy bears, maybe we should give them a round of applause. And it's also just a place. This place is history. The many of you, over the years I've known you, we've done fundraisers for this and fundraisers for that to make this meditation retreat center available for everybody. It is sometimes cool here, but as I said, when it's cold, it extends your life. Just like putting things in the refrigerator extends their life. So you've been in the refrigerator for 7 or 8 days, and hopefully you've had enough warmth here, and it's much better than last year's. Remember, Susan, last year's when we had the retreat, the air conditioner stopped working. Yeah, and that's because of the cockroach. Do you hear that story? This is why I've got lots of compassion for cockroaches. One of those cockroaches last year was looking for a nice warm place, you know, to get away from the cold, and went into the air conditioner and then to the electrics, and it was more warm than it thought and imagined or expected, because it short-circuited something and got fried. I'm sure it saw some nimitous flashes of light before it passed away. But as a result of that, it fused the aircon, and it took us a long time to find out the cause of it, the fried cockroach. But it was amazing that our secretary called up the insurance and said, "Are we covered? For what? For fried cockroaches?" And they said, what are you talking about? I said, "The cockroach got in our system and it fried it." And they said, "I've never heard this before, ever," the insurance agent. But they checked up and it was covered. So anyway, so we got the money back, which was very nice. So this year we didn't have any cockroaches, but somehow or other, just to keep traditions, the electricity turned off this morning. But it wasn't a cockroach. And anyway, it came back just in time. Just in time for breakfast. So you could have a nice cup of coffee. Otherwise, you'd have been very upset. And you'd have probably got home right now. But it's nice that we have this comfort here. And this is a lot of work. And also, behind the scenes, the caretakers. And I think that Christina, she's always a very humble, hard worker, never wants any praise, but she's in there, in the sound room, probably listening. So let's hear it for Christina, caretakers. Okay. And always there, making sure everyone's okay and looking after everything. But this is a communal resource. In the old days, we used to have to hire this retreat center and that retreat center, which means we had to couldn't arrive early, we had to leave on time. And it was very, very difficult. Some people, you know, like Susan, are going to stay on a bit longer. Some people come earlier. It gives us much more flexibility when this is our place. And so there's been so many people who have been donors here, and not just the donors, that you all know the story, that is my desire, so any mistakes, please, you tell me off. I was the one who stood my ground against some of the committee members who said, we can't afford having en-suites for every room. It's too expensive. Have communal toilets. And I said, no. I want people who stay here to have comfort. So if you enjoyed your own en-suite, a round of applause for you know who. Middle way. But one of the most inspiring stories which I always like to share with people is that so often, you know, that we don't have faith and trust that if you have a good project it will always come to fruition. This project cost about 5 million Australian, I think. It's a lot of money. And it was many times when we got the bills, and I thought, oh my goodness, we're going to go bankrupt, I'm going to go to jail up the road. But it's amazing, just every time that something came up, someone managed to sort of give a donation. And we always just managed to pay the bills. Only just. But that's really interesting, isn't it? You never actually just does say that you are going to pay the bills easily. It's only just. There's something interesting about that. That when you have a good cause and you really, really believe in it, and then other beings seem to come to help you. It always happens just at the last minute. A supernatural story for you. At first I didn't think this was supernatural, but the more I think about it and the more I, as time goes by, the more I am convinced that this was a special occasion. You went to our Bhikkhuni monastery, our nuns' monastery, Dharmasara, some time ago. I don't know if they told you the history of how it started. How that having built Bodhinyana Monastery, and it was going well, that people always thought, now what about places for women to practice? And yeah, you can have monks and nuns in the same monastery, but if you have that, the monks are always the bosses, and it's not really conducive. So it's not free and liberating as you need in our modern world. So I put a little article in our newsletter, are we interested in starting a monastery for women? And of course, you just wrote an article, you opened up a bank account, and the money just trickled in. $10 here, $5 there. And basically, it wasn't going anywhere. Until, in front of the kitchen in Bodhinyana Monastery some years ago, this gentleman came up in an ordinary looking car, like an old car. And he came out and he was wearing Australian national dress, which I mentioned yesterday, was a pair of flip-flop sandals, shorts, and a dirty old shirt. And he asked to see me, and he said to me that he was a Buddhist. I'd never seen him before. And he said his wife, a couple of days earlier, had just given birth to their first child. And he wanted to celebrate or do something, you know, to celebrate his first child, who happened to be a girl. And he told me, I read that you are starting a monastery for women. And I don't know if my daughter would ever want to be a Buddhist nun, but I want her to have the opportunity. I want her to have the chance, just in case. And this is my celebration for my daughter's birth, my first child. He was Caucasian, quite old, and he handed over a check. And I'm usually very calm, but when I saw the numbers on the check, I confess my hand was shaking. $250,000. He gave it to me, didn't ask for a receipt. He disappeared, he went. I've never seen him since. Don't know who he is. He hasn't come back to ask, you know, whether how the monastery is going, or how the money's been spent. And that was the weird part. after handing over the check, which didn't bounce, that I'd never seen him again. That was weird. Maybe it's like that gentleman who appeared in the jungle to feed a monk. Sometimes I begin to wonder whether that was the case. But that's how our Nuts Monastery got its boost to get serious, and we started. And also, I share the story of the floor you're sitting on that side. You've maybe had builders before, and the builders don't always keep the five precepts. When they say they're going to finish by a certain time, add another couple of months on, and then maybe correct. So, when it was coming close to completion, the builders, I asked them, said, when are you going to finish? And they said, oh, by January, for sure. So I thought, maybe March. And so we had going to have our first Easter retreat, I think in April. And he said, are you sure? He said, yeah, no trouble at all. And I believed them. And of course, I organized the opening ceremony. I think it was in April or May sometime in, how long ago was that? 2009? Something like that. But anyway, about 2009, I think. And we had all the dignitaries come, and including, as I say, the then ex-premier of Western Australia, Jeff Gallop, invited all these people. It's so hard to organize everything and just get it all together. And month before, is it going to be completed in time? There was some delay. Oh, yeah, no trouble. A week before, oh, no trouble. A day before, sorry. Everything was completed except the bamboo floor on your side. And they tried to get workmen in and they didn't want to do it. So it was in the afternoon, before the opening ceremony the following morning. Half the floor had no bamboo on it, just concrete. So what happens? What happens is when something like that comes about, the special force comes along to help out. The monks. And you think we're lazy monks? You should have seen these monks. They realized they had to finish this floor off, you know, before the following morning. And I think it was till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. They worked. They were just completing it. And the ceremony would start about 7 or 8 o'clock. So the floor you're sitting on over there was laid by monks in the middle of the night, not sleeping, working, not for themselves, for you, so that you can have a nice meditation retreat center. And that's really, I was really impressed. Sometimes people say the monks are fat and lazy. The first part might be right for some people, but lazy, absolutely not. So that's inspiring. Everybody helps, does whatever they can to actually to make a better world and a good world. We always hear the stories of people who do the wrong things, who cheat and who break their precepts. But it's wonderful hearing inspiring stories of people who really come and help when it's really necessary and are not really worrying about, you know, their sleep or their food or whatever. That just needs to be done. We're just going to go and do it. And I'd rather have that as this retreat center than have some really, really wealthy donor who builds $10 million, just go build it. Because I had that offer twice in Sri Lanka. They said, you're a good teacher, we want to build you a retreat center. Anywhere you want, you design it, doesn't matter how much money, we'll pay for it. And they were really wealthy people. And they just say, we'll build you a retreat center. What did I say? Nah. Already got one. What do I want another one for? And it's also the way it's built. It's much better if everybody comes together, everybody joins in, including the monks, you know, including me, sort of designing some of this stuff. And that way, you know, it's our retreat center. And that's one of the reasons why I usually say, anyone, big donors, just give it to someone else. We like the small ones. The small ones, the kind ones, so everybody has a place here. And this place belongs to you. It's yours. And that's one of the wonderful things. And that also means, if you don't charge very much. In fact, there's no real charge because all of those booking bonds and stuff are fully refundable. If you didn't like this retreat or something was wrong, you are always welcome to ask for your money back. Honestly, that's a promise. You can always ask for your money back. Even the books which you buy, if you don't like them, you can ask for your money back. That's always the case. You can ask, you won't get it back. You can always ask for it. That's on my account. And it's also, as you've learned here, the power of laughter and kindness and forgiveness. When we laugh together, it bonds us. When we laugh together, we love together and we have a happy time together. So I don't know why it was that in some retreats, as I mentioned, in some meditation methods or in some monasteries, you're not allowed to laugh. Even smiling. Wipe that smile off your face. This is serious. We're serious meditators. They're not really serious meditators. They look it on the surface, but in the inside just get too tense. Far too tense. Here comes another bad joke. There was a man who went to the psychiatrist and he said, sometimes I feel like I'm a marquee. You know what a marquee is? You have these big events and this canvas covered stuff. And said, other times I feel I'm a wigwam. You know what the indigenous Indians in North America used to live in. Sometimes I think I'm a wigwam, sometimes I think I'm a marquee. What's wrong with me? And the psychologist got it straight away. The trouble with you, sir, is you're too tense. Oh. That's an English joke. A marquee is a type of tent, a wigwam is a type of tent. You're too tense. So, what it does is when you laugh, you get energy, you get happiness, you get joy, you engage. And so sometimes, that means, even yesterday when I left to give a session for this young 7-year-old boy, was a 7 or 8-year-old boy, Manuka, I forget. But anyway, he died very young, unexpectedly. So all his school friends were there last night. And you can't, if you've got school friends. Now, he was a Sri Lankan boy. Most of his school friends were Caucasians. And you can't talk deep Dhamma to school kids. So he told a lot of stories of how to deal with, you know, the loss of a loved one. And they really enjoyed it. They enjoyed it. Because that was a celebration of their friend. Not with sadness and tears, but with happiness, celebrating a life, literally. Always remembering the wonderful times we share together, instead of always dwelling just on the two bad bricks of when a person passed away. So that way, you know, we are learning how to face life, you know, with some happiness and laughter. And I've already told the monks, when I die, which eventually I have to, but I've got no plans, don't worry. I don't plan. That, what I want the monks to do, and if you happen to be there at the time, please come up at the eulogies and tell your memories of the worst joke. To be remembered with laughter and fun. Instead of, oh, dead. So that's much more in tune with the Buddha's teachings. To celebrate, to look at life and all of the wonderful teachings and happiness and joy which you've had here over the last 8 or 9 days. And take that back with you. Hopefully there hasn't been too many complaints. If there is, you can just put them in the rubbish bin and we'll send them to the tip later on. But all of the wonderful things you've enjoyed here, focus on successes, on happiness, on what works. I tell that in business schools, every now and again you go over to teach at places like Google and Facebook and other places. And I say, why is it that people always focus on the faults and mistakes? Why is it that in a company something goes wrong and have to have so many debriefings and talking about the mistakes? And when things go right and they have successful marketing campaigns or successful business models, why is it that we just take that for granted and don't even talk about it afterwards? Nothing that's not the secret for success in business. Even in business, if something works, keep talking about it. Have a meeting about why it worked until you learn the secrets of success instead of dwelling upon mistakes. And even those of you who will never be monks or nuns, who have partners in life, when you have a terrible day together, something goes wrong, someone doesn't turn up, like that story of the man who asked his darling wife on February the 13th, the day before Valentine's Day, "Darling, what can I get you as a Valentine's Day gift?" And she said, "I need nothing because I've got you." Wasn't that sweet? But he'd been married long enough to know that's not what she meant. So instead, he said, "No, I want to get you something, a gift. What would you like?" And she said, "Diamonds." "Something with diamonds in. Anything with diamonds in." And he smiled, "Okay, darling." And the next day, he offered her this beautiful wrapped Valentine's Day gift. Little box. And when she opened the box, expecting a necklace or a diamond brooch, she found in the box a pack of playing cards. It had 13 diamonds in it. Well, that's what you said. Anything with diamonds in. So when that happens, don't get divorced, it costs too much. But when things go wrong like that, we always remember them. When things go right, that's when we should remember and recall those wonderful memories we had. So when you go back to Hong Kong or to Jakarta or wherever, there's still a few people in Indonesia here, or to wherever, or to Canningvale, to your shop, see where things are going. So when you go back, always remember the wonderful things you learnt here. The positive attitude, the kindness, just the joy. The fact that you can spend 7 or 8 days here having fun. And people will say, "Well, did you go swimming? Did you go hiking? What did you do? Play tennis? Watch the movies? What do you do?"
Nothing.
And you can be so happy doing nothing. That is really radical. People say, "What? You did nothing all day?" "Yeah, we slept. Listened to jokes and funny stories. We meditated and became peaceful." And then they find, wow, you don't need to go shopping or touring around old ruins or seeing the Great Wall of China. He said, "I didn't see the Great Wall of China. I just went over to Bodhinyana and saw the Great Wall of Bodhinyana." That's long enough. Two bad bricks. The two bad bricks. You know, for years I forgot where they were. I couldn't find them anymore because they weren't important to me. It's amazing. If it's a mistake, you remember it, you remember who it was and why they did it. Everything is just so clear to you because you're obsessed about it. But when it's just a little mistake and it's in proportion, you don't worry about it, you forget where it is. You know that when I was a monk in the jungles, this story was very important to me. I was in the jungle meditating, and it's after the first cicadas, the first evening is quite noisy, but then it all settles down and becomes very, very quiet in the Southeast Asian jungle, maybe about 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock. But there are wild animals in the jungle, you know, things like bears and elephants and tigers, of course. No, the real tigers, not the tigers, the tigers. And those tigers were dangerous. People always told me that tigers never attack monks. There was never a known case of a tiger eating a monk. But then, because I was a scientist and I was skeptical, I said, well, you wouldn't know it, would you? Because no one would tell the tale. The monk would just disappear. The tigers won't admit it. So, still, I was very dangerous. So you're always a bit wary of animals in the jungle at night time. So there I was, meditating, very peaceful. And I heard a sound. Jungle animal. It's very peaceful. The jungle is just so much twigs and leaves, and many of the leaves are dry. You can hear things coming because they crunch the understory. And so, I had my eyes closed. Even though I opened my eyes, it was pitch black, wouldn't be able to see anything. I had a flashlight there just in case. And I heard the sound. And of course, you know, you were careful, you were mindful, and listened to that sound. What was it? And after listening very carefully, it could only be a small animal, nothing dangerous. So I just carried on watching my breathing, breathing in, breathing out. But then as it came closer, it actually sounded much more than a small animal. Now, maybe a middle-sized animal, like one of the small mouse deer in the jungle, or even like the civet cats. So I listened carefully and said, oh, that's all it is. Still not dangerous. And then I went back to my meditation, my breath, nice and peaceful, breathing in, breathing out. But as it came closer, it was coming right towards me, whatever it was. As it came closer, you could hear the sound of the branch of the twigs breaking, branches breaking. And I realized I'd totally underestimated this animal. It wasn't a medium animal at all, it was a big one. You could tell by the sound it made. And I started to get scared. It was coming right towards me, that could be a tiger. And so I broke my meditation, opened my eyes, got out my flashlight and searched for this tiger, which I was sure it was. And as I was searching, I saw it, a tiny mouse about this big. That's what it was. And it taught me that when you're afraid, when you have fear, you exaggerate. I thought I was being mindful. I heard this. But a tiny mouse, by the time it went through my fear and into my consciousness, it came out as a tiger. And I was just so shocked. I thought I was so aware, so mindful, so just not adding on to anything. I didn't realize just how fear can totally distort your perception, making a small mouse a huge tiger. But you know, I actually did see a tiger once, came face to face with a tiger, this huge tiger. And it's only about maybe that far away, the monkey, face to face with a tiger. And you know, it's amazing, being a monk for so many years, I wasn't afraid at all. No fear, it was weird. Perhaps it was because the tiger was in a zoo and I was outside his big pine bark. I wasn't afraid. Did I catch you? I'm a very sneaky tree bark. But not in the jungle. I never seen a tiger in the jungle with no protection, with bars in between me and the tiger. But you saw many other animals, many big animals, the snakes especially. And you know the snakes, if you're kind to them, they'll never bite you. And you know, they're crawling up for you and, you know, crawling over you, these snakes. And you know what they were. They said that 99, there's 100 species of snake in Thailand. I was taught this when I first went there. 100 species of snake, 99, if they bit you, they were venomous, really dangerous. And the other one strangled you to death. All big snakes, very dangerous. They will never harm you. And a lot of kindness and compassion to snakes. And I remember this one occasion, snake stories now. I was doing some chanting. It was a chanting of the Patimokkha. And I was doing the chanting, and one of the other monks was sitting in front of me with his hands up. And on his back, I saw a little head poke up. A snake. A snake had crawled up his back while I was listening to the chanting. And then the monk turned around, because he saw in the corner of his eye something was there. And the snake turned around. And so the two of them were eyeballing one another. It's totally ridiculous. And the snake didn't know what to do. The monk didn't know what to do. But the monk very gently just, you know, put his robe down. So the snake could gently fall off and just crawl away. Snake was not going to bite anybody. Human food is not what snakes eat. They only bite if they're afraid. So that's one of the reasons why a little bit of kindness, and the animals are always kind to you. That's one of the reasons why it's a delight to go to Bodhinyana Monastery at lunchtime. See, not only the kangaroos are not afraid of you, sometimes they're a bit of a pest. You have to push them out the path. They've got no respect, the kangaroos. I'm the abbot. I'm a senior monk. But will they get off the path? No way. You do, but not them. But I don't mind. They're so cute. And also the parrots and the other birds who come around and just enjoy the place. And you enjoy them. For those of you who went to, I think it was on your itinerary, you went to Kamishan Wildlife Park. It's a waste of money. You should just come to Bodhinyana Zoo instead. You know that's happened a few times. I'd be walking just around the grounds and a big, not a truck, but a minibus pulled up. And I went up to them and said, can I assist you? And they said, no, we're not here to see the monks, we're here to see your kangaroos. That's all they came for. Not for us, just for the kangaroos. So it really put me in my place. I was looking for this company. That's the kangaroos. But you have the beautiful fun and happiness, and that becomes a different way of looking at life. Yeah, sure that you have problems and difficulties in life. Things don't go according to plan, but there's no reason to get upset and angry. You're going to the airport this afternoon, I don't know if your flight is going to be cancelled or if it's going to arrive there on time. I always tell people, don't fly Qantas. There's always lots of turbulence, always a bumpy ride. You know why Qantas is the most bumpy airline in the world? Because it's a flying kangaroo. And so the way we fly, we just, whatever happens. There was a time years ago when I was flying to Indonesia to give it in the early days, but even so, I forget where we're landing, and there was a lot of people waiting for me to give the talk. I think it might have been in Seoul or something years ago. That was a long time ago, and it was arranged by Venerable Paniwara, and I was going to give a talk there, and I went to the airport, and the Garuda flight was cancelled. It wasn't delayed, it was cancelled. 24 hours, the next flight. And so I saw so many people getting angry. They were at the counter, banging on the counter, you can't do this to us, we've got a connection, you're spoiling our holidays. And you know the only response they got was a bruised fist. Bang, bang, bang. No one could make that aircraft come. It was a total waste of time. You're getting angry at something which you cannot change. And as for me, okay, we can always give another talk another day. And anyway, I did manage to contact Venerable Panyawara and give my apologies. I can't come. It's just impermanence. This is a Dhamma teaching. All your expectations and plans, some work, some don't work, so adapt. And anyway, I gave the explanation to Venerable Panyawara to tell to all the people if they were disappointed. It's nobody's fault, because that was a time when Indonesia was almost an epicenter of bird flu. Remember the bird flu time? And I explained Garuda's a bird. The aircraft has got the flu. And that was taking some negativity and actually making it a positive experience. So that way we don't need to be totally overcome by the expectations which aren't fulfilled. I'm not sure what you expected when you came on this retreat, but I hope you go back with some wisdom and happiness and joy. If religion is supposed to solve the problems in life, then it comes with starting to understand how your heart works and how to have happiness no matter what's happening. How to let go of the burdens of the past. And just to finish off before I ask for any last questions and give a blessing for you all before we finish the retreat. A few weeks ago, people were asking me serious questions about Buddhism, not just meditation, but what we can actually do to make a more peaceful world. Especially if people get so negative, with things like religious extremism and terrorism and all that stuff. And I remember that somebody was told me, they came here and they told me there's a TV program in Perth called Q&A program. It's supposed to be very well known in Australia, Q&A. And they were discussing, the terrorism, especially in the Middle East, and how to bring peace to that very disturbed part of the world. And they had on the panel of experts the editor of the Spectator magazine in UK. It's a very, very well-known magazine with a large circulation. And when they asked the editor of the Spectator magazine what he thought was a solution to the world problem of violent extremism, he said, he quoted some research which had just recently been done in Sussex University in UK. And this obviously must have been published in the Spectator because he quoted it. He said research over there, very strong scientific based research, was proving that when people meditate, it affects so many people in the environment. Even in the locality, people get far less violent and more kind and more peaceful. So on air in the ABC, this is why I heard it, the Spectator magazine editor suggested a solution to solving problems in the Middle East was to parachute into the conflict zones Buddhist monks and nuns. And when I heard that, I started thinking of some of those monks in my monastery. I wouldn't mind parachuting. People like, that's very unkind, I can't do that. That's other lady ones. But it is true that your kindness, your laughter, your peace is infectious. It is like a bird flu, but this is meditation flu. This is calm, peace, forgiving, kindness flu, which once you're infected, will infect all the people you meet later on when you go back to your home. You will find that when you say, oh, that's so selfish, you just sitting here just having fun when there's so many problems in the world. No. What you do here will rub off on all the people you meet in the next few days, few weeks, few years. Your attitude changes. And that is how we spread the teachings of peace and kindness. You can write books, but only the people who know you read them. You can go knocking door to door, but people usually slam the door in your face. The best way to spread teachings of peace and forgiveness and kindness and happiness, teachings of freedom, are to live that life. If you live that life, that is where it rubs off, and that is where it spreads. So many people come to this place by word of mouth. We don't advertise. You don't have billboards in Hong Kong or in Indonesia, Buddhist meditation retreat, sort of register now. You don't need that. Even in our centre in Perth, which many of you visited, we tried that once. We advertised in the newspaper for meditation, never again. We got swabbed, couldn't fit anyone in. So we don't need to do that. Word of mouth. And you are that word of mouth. If it's working for you, if you're kind, you're a much improved person when you go back. People will know, ah, yes, you've been meditating. That is how we share the goodness and happiness of everything which you've learned here. Not by what you say, but where it comes from. Not by how you act, but the kindness behind those actions. That is what people see. And that is what people really need in this world today. Not theories. I've often said in another talk also about the problem with extremism in our modern world. The reason why people would harm one another is because they believe in dogmas and ideologies rather than believing in their heart. Even the ideologies and theories of Buddhism, we can argue with one another. We can take these thick Tripitakas, and the Abhidharma is one of the biggest ones, and hit each other over the head with the Abhidharma. Who's right and who's wrong? There's something wrong there, there's something missing there. So we don't read the books. We do read the books, but what we also must read is our heart. Feel what's in here, and then you know what's right, you know what's wrong, you know what's good, and you know what's harmful. If you read the books, you can get so confused. There's so many books, so many teachings, so many teachers. It's confusing. But if you trust what's in here, what the heart says, that is far more accurate and far more reliable. And if a person could feel their heart rather than their dogma or ideology, they could never pull a gun and shoot somebody. They could never harm or hurt somebody. You just can't do it if you feel in here. And the story I said was, this was my lifetime when I was a young man. It was the Vietnam War. And you may remember one of the great atrocities in that war was what they called the My Lai Massacre. And I still remember the names. Lieutenant Kelly was ordered to go with his soldiers into this village and to kill every man, woman and child, indiscriminate. And there was a journalist who found out about that and was published, and it was a big scandal. It's how the US military were just doing what was like genocide. But 30 years after that, there was a TV program where they wanted to find out the results, what that did to all those soldiers who were involved in that massacre. And that was the amazing thing about this documentary. Nearly all of the soldiers who followed orders because they thought they had to, They were all had lots of social, lots of emotional, lots of psychological problems. They're addicted to drugs, addicted to alcohol, never being able to be in a good relationship, basically having a very, very difficult time living in the rest of their life with the trauma of what they did. Doesn't matter what religion you are, or no religion, that affects you. And you can't get it out of your head. It's karma, and it's result. But they, like every one of these stories, there's always an exception, something which stands out. And that was an African-American soldier who refused to go into that village and kill. And even though he knew the consequences of his action, refusing an order from the military would be 3 years in one of the military jails in the United States. And that was really heavy-duty prison. He knew what he was up for, but he said he just could not kill. No. Men, women and children, just for no reason. So he went to jail for 3 years. But now, he's the most happy, content, joyful person. Now he refused to do bad karma, even though there were some immediate consequences. And he reaped the benefits of that. But the interesting part was, the reason I tell this story, was they asked him, why? How could you do that? You know, were you following your religious precepts? He said, I had no religion. Was it because of the ethics you were taught at school? I hardly went to school. I came from such a poor part of a ghetto. I only joined the military just to escape the inevitable crime and drugs which was waiting for me. There was hardly any other way out. I joined the military to have a life. But when I was told to go in and kill indiscriminately, said I knew that was wrong. I knew I just couldn't do it. It was wrong. Don't tell me why. I had no religion, no faith. I knew you can't do that. And that's why I say to please trust your heart, not the books or the dogma. If we could be like that African American soldier, hardly any education, no dogma. He knew you can't do those things, it hurts, it's bad. And so he stood up for his beliefs, which were coming from the religion, coming from the heart. And that's always what I encourage you to do. In this retreat, I've tried very diligently to open up your heart. I'd made that joke to someone earlier that said, I am a heart surgeon. I think somebody had to go because someone was having heart surgery. I'm a heart surgeon, but the difference between me and an ordinary heart surgeon is when I open your heart, I leave it open. I don't sew it back up again. That's the only difference. And that's the aim of meditation of the Dhamma. Open your heart, let yourself feel, and then you'll know what is Dhamma, what is not Dhamma, what is the right path and what is not the right path. And no one will ever be able to tell you otherwise. You'll have your confidence going beyond that doubt. And that's the only way I encourage you to live. So, actually there were some questions here. Okay, I did want to ask some questions. So I've got 3 minutes to answer the questions. When you have gotten jhana, at what point do you turn the energy towards vipassana? And this is something you have to think about. No, it happens naturally. You don't do vipassana, it does you. So just let go, relax, and wisdom will come to you. Oh my goodness. I've got a question here which I cannot answer. This has got me stumped. This is the deepest question I've had all of the retreat. Wow. Whoever did this, I'm sorry, you should be sitting here. Dear Ajahn, please can you explain if the Buddha has completely gone, how we invoke him or what's at him? There is one of the key sayings in the sutras. The one who sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma. The one who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. Can you see the Dhamma now?
Yes.
So you can see the Buddha. Is the Dhamma alive?
Yes.
So is the Buddha. So the Buddha is not a person. It's what that person represents. The teachings, the path of peace, of kindness, of freedom. That's what the Dhamma is. That's what the Buddha embodies. So if anyone said, the Buddha died 2,500 years ago, is gone. The Buddha's alive. Because the Dhamma is alive. The one who sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma. And you recognize the Buddha when it is seen. Because it's a Dhamma giving rise to peace, to kindness. Non-discrimination, no space between peoples. Well, actually, the space between peoples, that's what connects us, doesn't divide us. The oceans in the world, which you're going to cross later on today, they don't divide people. It's what connects us together. The strings, which are unbreakable between human beings and animals and all that's alive in this world. So we can look at it two ways. Oceans, seas which divide, or which connect. The spaces which separate us, or the space which surrounds us and envelops us and connects us together. It's just which way you wish to regard it. And that is the essence of the Dhamma. It's not the world, it's the way you perceive the world. How you look at it. Change the way you look at it. And you're free. Thank you for those questions. And thank you for your company and for all the laughter and the endurance of the bad jokes for the last 8 or 9 days. So now I'll give you the final blessing. Just to let you go, I have to let you go too. And unfortunately, you have to let your teddy bears go. But you can come back and check them out next year. Sabha Roga Vinimuto Sabha Santa Pavajito Sabha Vela Mati Gando Nibuto Chato Wangbawa Sabhi Jiyo Viva Chanta Sabha Roga Vina satu mate bhavan vandarayo Sukhiti gayugo Pavapi vadaka sile Sanichang vuta pacharino Chataro dhamma vatanti Ayu vano Sukhang Palang Sadhu Sadhu Sadhu. Very good. So I think you all know what to do now. Just put your stuff away, tidy it up, and have a safe journey back here whenever you can come back.